Hello and a very warm welcome to our weekly podcast, The World Outside. I'm Maha Siddiqui. The disengagement at the line of actual control on the Pangong Lake is underway. This is happening after 9 months of standoff that obviously had a fallout diplomatically on the bilateral relations as well between India and China. Meanwhile, the South China Sea is also seeing activity after the new Biden administration took over. What do we make of all these developments? Joining me now, former FS of India, who was also India's ambassador to both China and the United States, Nirupma Rao. Many thanks, Ms. Rao, for speaking with us.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here,
ma'am. Ma'am, the first question is with regards to the LAC. What, according to you, prompted this willingness on part of China after 9 rounds of co-commander-level talks and 6 rounds of WMCC talks to finally disengage?
I think we should view these developments as a mutual agreement to disengage on the part of both India and China. India has been saying all along that the status quo ante prior to April 2020 should be restored. The Chinese had accused us of various things. In terms of the situation along the line of actual control. So there was this mutual trading of insinuations and the blame game had gone on for some time. I think I would look at the latest developments as being a very welcome resolution of a situation of close confrontation, which could very well have led to protracted conflict between the two sides, along a line of actual control that, as you know, has not been clarified by either side. There's been no agreement as to where the line of actual control really lies, neither on the maps or in the minds, as one Chinese diplomat put it very long ago. So given all these very complicated, complex factors that inform the situation, I think we should look at the latest developments, the announcements made both at Beijing and in New Delhi, that the two countries, the military commanders of the two countries, have agreed on a phased, verified, coordinated, synchronized method of disengagement.
Ma'am, that brings us to the question of what was China angling for in the first place? What was it they were looking for? What have they achieved in the 9 months?
I'm no reader of the Chinese mind. The fact is that you have a very muscular, over-assertive, expansionist China today. And that expansionism or that attitude is a marker of the Xi Jinping regime in Beijing. You see it manifest not only on the land border with India, but you also see it in the maritime environment of the South China Sea and the East China Sea, with the correspondent impact on relations with Japan, with the Philippines, with Vietnam. And also, you also see it, for, that's just to cite a few instances, and you also see it in terms of a heightened belligerence on the Taiwan question. We saw how the national security law was implemented in Hong Kong, how the democracy protests have been quelled by the Chinese authorities. So all of these factors, you can stitch them together to build a picture of a very assertive China that is no longer willing to lie low or bide its time. This is the face of Xi Jinping. He tells his PLA, his People's Liberation Army, his defense establishment, to be ready for war, to be ready to stand up, to be ready to fight. So this is what I think also occasioned the aggression, the aggressiveness that we saw, that we witnessed along the line of actual control in the past. And therefore, I would say, even as we welcome the latest developments, that we should be prepared for a continuation of this Chinese attitude in terms of its dealing with the outside world. This is a risen China, not just a rising China, it's a risen China. And all of the world has to deal with it and to devise strategies, not only to cope with this rise, but also to be able to create an equilibrium that balances the strife and is able to withstand this force emanating from China.
Ma'am, since you mentioned both Taiwan and Hong Kong, these were also points that were raised by the new U.S. President Joe Biden when he had his first phone call with Xi Jinping after his inauguration. He raised all these issues that are sensitive in some sense to China, Hong Kong, Taiwan, as well as the human rights abuses in Xinjiang and also their aggression in the region. How do you read that phone call between the two leaders, and where do you see the U.S.-China rivalry going from here on?
Even if you do not use the word rivalry, you have to use the word competition. And the strategic competition between China and the United States will continue, will become a defining factor of this relationship. And you add to that the Biden administration's emphasis on core democratic values, the emphasis that they are placing on ties with democracies, with like-minded democracies, their emphasis on human rights questions, the treatment of minorities. So these factors, these principles that define the outlook of Mr. Biden towards the outside world, they will not be able to ignore, the U.S. will not be able to ignore these factors when it comes to dealing with China. So on the one hand, they will continue to deal with China on issues where there can be a meeting of minds or at least a possible degree of agreement. There will be engagement on issues like climate change, on pandemic control, on non-proliferation. They will have to work with China on Iran, for instance. So all that they're going to seek that kind of common ground with China. Whether China will play ball on that, we do not know. Because the Chinese are also very adept in seeking, rewards for that kind of behavior. And they will obviously want the Americans to ease pressure on these very issues we talked about, whether it's human rights or whether it's Chinese belligerence on Taiwan. To what extent America will continue with its one-China policy. So you're going to see a very muddled, very flux-like situation when it comes to dealing with China. You see, post-Brexit, the UK has to devise its own security strategy. What is Europe going to do vis-a-vis China? Most importantly, what are the countries in the region going to do about China? Now, the Japanese have been able to transact their relations with China in some areas. There have been tensions in other areas like trade and economic engagement and even people-to-people ties. Those links have continued, have developed. So there's been a balancing that they've been able to achieve. The smaller countries in the region, the Southeast Asian countries, the ASEAN countries, for instance, ASEAN doesn't have really one consolidated, defined attitude towards China. Some countries in ASEAN, have made their own bargains with China, or they live in the shadow of the Chinese, because the Chinese put a lot of economic and, just geostrategic pressure on those countries. Some of the bigger or more, dominant countries, they are worried, certainly. I would say everybody is worried about the growing nature of Chinese pressures that they face. They would like more of a multipolarity in the region. They certainly don't want a heightening of tensions between China and the United States and being forced to take sides on issues. So you see how variegated this situation is. It's very difficult to draw definite conclusions on what directions the situation will take. But ultimately, I think it's in the interest of the rest of Asia, and especially the democracies in the region, to work closely with countries like the United States, who've been a presence in this region for the last 70 years, who've worked with countries, who've built alliances, who've built partnerships. I think the way to go is to cooperate with these like-minded countries to ensure that we put in place a rule-based order for the Indo-Pacific and that tensions are reduced and we're able to create a better balance and equilibrium.
That brings us to the question of South China Sea as well. Ma'am, we saw a naval exercise being conducted by U.S. tri-groups last week. Nimitz and Roosevelt were there. And what message do you think that the U.S. through these exercises was sending to China? Because China responded very sharply to it, saying that U.S. is trying to flex its muscles in this region.
Well, the South China Sea doesn't belong to China alone. You know, there are so many other countries that have interests, economic, trading interests. We, all of us, you know, from the point of view of maritime trade and communication and navigation, we have an interest in ensuring that we have a free and open Indo-Pacific, and the South China Sea is very much a part of the Indo-Pacific. So the Chinese reaction, of course, was to be expected. You know, they always have this knee-jerk response to what the Americans or the other navies do in the region to counter Chinese activities in order to emphasize the freedom of navigation and the free and open passage for all these ships, whether they are, you know, whether they belong to America or any other country, but particularly merchant marine traffic, which carries on its backs all of the world's trade. I think it's important to ensure that these channels of navigation and communication along our maritime environment remain free and open. So it is necessary, I think, for the Chinese to be told from time to time that their actions and their approach to this South China Sea and in effect to the entire maritime expanse that we see around us has to be regulated by rules, has to be regulated by a certain set of principles that enable all countries to practice peaceful coexistence.
Ma'am, do you see any connect between then the move that has happened at the LAC and what we are seeing in South China Sea? In some sense, as China is getting a signal from the U.S., the new Biden administration, that they are going to be just as tough on China as the Trump administration, although with a different approach, are they trying to close fronts with others like India to take on the Americans? Can that connect be drawn? Or is it too far-fetched?
I think there could be a number of reasons for the disengagement. First and foremost, of course, both India and China have, in a sense, worked together, if you can call that as working together, to effect this disengagement. It has been as much in China's interest as it has been in India's interest. And we shouldn't look at it in a unilateral way or from one angle alone. The second thing is that within China, they have this important anniversary of the centenary of the Chinese Communist Party coming up this year. They have the Winter Olympics next year. They have a meeting, the Freedom of the National People's Congress. So they have a lot of activity within the country that I think would divert their attention or would require essentially a concentration of attention and activity. So I think essentially would have been in their interest to ensure that tensions along the land borders that they have, particularly with India, do not boil over. In any case, I think we should be prepared to welcome what has happened. This disengagement was necessary. I think the challenge is to ensure that it goes through smoothly, that we do not become triumphalist about it like we did after Doha. I think there is a tendency among our public opinion to become very triumphalist, you know, see the Chinese have withdrawn, look what we've achieved. Please don't think that the story ends here. There are challenges in pockets all along the line of actual control, not only in Ladakh, but also in Sikkim and in Arunachal Pradesh. Eternal vigilance is the price, I think, that we have to pay for dealing with this situation. So, trust, there's been a lot of erosion. In fact, trust between India and China has eroded completely. The relationship is profoundly stressed. It continues to be profoundly stressed. And until and unless you're able to effect a proper and enduring and durable regime of peace and tranquility along the line of actual control, this is the relationship will continue to be in deep territory.
Many thanks, Nirupama Rao, for speaking with News18.com. That's it then this week on our podcast, The World Outside. Join us again next week.